Bell.
Good evening. We're going to talk a little bit about the Crusades during this session, if I can recollect anything about them. When I go to Israel, people are oftentimes surprised by some of the sites that I tend to want to take, the tours that I take to. They while I certainly love to visit all of the traditional sites, what we can know of as the actual sites from the Old Testament and from the New Testament. Another one of my passions is church history, and the fact is that the land of Israel is full of church history. I love to go up to the northern part of Israel, along the coast of the Mediterranean, to the great harbor city of Haifa, and just to the north of Haifa is the city of Acre, which boasts a magnificent medieval fortress harbor, underground caverns, vast networks of tunnels. Whenever you take Americans there, it feels like the set of Goonies or something. It's just a wonderful, delightful world apart from our world. Just to the north of Tel Aviv, one of the first places that we ever go to on these tours is to another little harbor city right on the edge of the Mediterranean called Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea Philippi wasn't even in existence, as far as anyone knew, until about 18-20 years ago, when a banana farmer was digging a new area for some vegetables with his trusty tractor, and he kept hitting these big stones. So he decided to dig the stones out of his garden plot, and he dug, and he dug, and he dug, and he dug, and he realized these aren't just any old stones, these are carved stones. And so he called in the archaeologists from the university in Jerusalem, Hebrew University, and they started to dig and dig, and they unearthed one of the most magnificent amphitheaters you can ever imagine. It is almost perfect. They've done some restoration on it, but this is a perfect amphitheater. It sits about 250 yards from the Mediterranean Sea and looks out at a magnificent piece of Roman aqueduct. So you're sitting in this theater. It's perfect. The acoustics are magnificent. Right in front of you is an aqueduct and then the Mediterranean Sea. Well, one of the things that I love the most about this particular site is that it's the only place that I know of where you can actually look at reserved parking spaces for the elite of the Roman rulers. For instance, I love just stopping by and hanging out at Pontius Pilate's personal reserved parking space. Literally, there is a stone there with Pontius Pilate's name on it, and it's where Pontius Pilate parked his chariots, I guess. I don't know. And it's his reserved spot. Kind of like, you know, PSLs at NFL stadiums, personal seat licenses or something. I don't know. But adjacent to the parking lot where Pontius Pilate parked his chariot is this magnificent boulevard with several glorious Byzantine and Frankish buildings built upon it. They are the ruins of the Crusader city built by St. Louis during the 7th and 8th Crusades. People come along and they see this stuff in the live, in the flesh, and they are astonished. In the city of Jerusalem itself, if you're over on the eastern side of the city, you come across the Pool of Bethesda, which is described in great detail in that great scene in the Gospel of John. And just adjacent to that is one of the most remarkable little chapels in the Frankish style, with the nice rounded archways and the small domes as you enter in. It's one of those places with astonishing acoustics. I don't know if you've ever been in a room with just amazing acoustics, but this room is a chapel that seats maybe 100. But at the center of the building, if you stand right in the middle and you start to sing, it will multiply your voice threefold. So it sounds like there are four of you standing there. And if you have a whole tour group in there, you sound like the Mormon Tabernacle Choir without the bad ties and white shirts. It's amazing. It, too, was built by the Crusaders. And, of course, if you go to any of the great sites in the city of Jerusalem, like the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, or south down to Bethlehem and go to the Church of the Nativity, though the foundations may have been laid by the Byzantines long before, the churches themselves were constructed by the Crusaders. We tend to think of the Crusades as this awful blight in church history, a time when somehow, some way, Christianity just went awry and we went on a wild rampage making enemies halfway across the globe. Now, the story of the Crusades is anything but that, as the magnificent architecture and the beautiful cities, the glorious harbors, the laid out gardens bear all too evident testimony. During the formative years of his faith, Muhammad had very little contact with Orthodox Christianity. You may have heard the stories from a few Christian merchants and caravanners who passed through the Hejaz on their way across the Arabian Peninsula from time to time, but those occasions were few and far between. Most of Muhammad's understanding of the gospel was actually filtered through the twisted heresies of Arianism, Nestorianism, and Monophysitism. If you know anything about early church history, during the 3rd and 4th centuries, these heresies racked the Christian world. Questions of Christology were raised, and you look at the structure of belief and the ecclesiology of these heresies, and you're quickly reminded of Islam itself. Arianism, a kind of Unitarian, simplified version of the gospel, which was no gospel at all. Nestorianism, which believed that the doctrines taught about Christ were too complex for the ordinary man to understand, and so Bishop Nestorius attempted to dumb down the gospel, bring it to its lowest common denominator, make it, you know, seeker-sensitive. And it, too, was a heresy. The interesting thing is that Arianism, Monophysitism, and Nestorianism were particularly popular in the Near East. They spread like wildfire through places like what is today Lebanon and Syria, and eastward toward Babylon and beyond that to the edges of Persia. And so if Muhammad had the gospel in any form, it was the gospel as filtered through these heresies. So he really didn't have much contact with the genuine Western culture and genuine Orthodox Christianity. As a result, that very limited and skewed exposure contrasted sharply with his contact with Judaism, as we have already seen. During his Hira, or his exile to Medina, he apparently had a series of acrimonious experiences with the Jewish community there, which, as we have seen, resulted in their annihilation. The result of all of this is that while the Quran hurls bitter invectives at the Jews, its condemnation of Christianity is rather mild, because at first it appears that Muhammad thought that all Christians believed what the Arians and the Monophysites and the Nestorians did, which was not too far afield from Islam itself. They were works righteousness in their orientation. They denied, if not the entire Trinity. With the Monophysites, it wasn't a total denial of the Trinity, but it was a denuding of the distinctiveness of the Trinity, at the very least. With the Nestorians and the Arians, of course, the Trinity was more than denuded. It was absolutely denied. So, Muhammad kind of had an affection for, a soft spot for Christians early on. Muhammad revered Jesus as one of the prophets. Surah chapter 2, verse 135. He believed that it was only a misunderstanding on the part of Christ's disciples that led them to worship him as the Son of God. And there was a good bit of confusion on Muhammad's part regarding the place of the Apostle Paul, for instance, and the other writers of New Testament books. Interesting, isn't it, that a prophet who hears directly from God gets so many facts wrong? At any rate, they still remained infidels in his mind and had to be dealt with as such, and yet he designated them with a special sort of label. They were not just any old infidels. They were people of the book. Now, technically, the Jews were people of the book, too, but because they were vermin, they were vermin of the book. Now, what that meant, ultimately, for Islam was that Christians were, wittingly or not, guilty of a kind of idolatry and would thus be faced with the judgment of God. They were subject to the wrath of the Ummah, the true community of Islam. But because they were people of the book, they were to be given the extra special opportunities to repent of this foolishness and come out of the darkness and be restored to the one true faith of Islam. In other words, Christians were targets of the jihad, but they had to be warned first. Like the Jews, they were either to be subjugated and brought under the dhimma, or they were to be ultimately killed. But they had a few extra minutes while the Jews were getting killed before they got theirs. No other option was actually tolerable to the faithful Muslim. According to Surah 21, verses 41 through 46, who will protect them by night or by day from the Lord of Justice? Yet they are unmindful of their Lord's remembrance. Have they any other means to protect them? Their idolatry will be powerless for their salvation. Nor shall they be protected from our scourge. Good things have been bestowed upon these men and upon their fathers. They have lived long and prospered, but now we shall invade their lands and curtail their borders. How can they then triumph? They have been warned by inspiration, but the deaf can hear nothing. Muhammad seemed to be much more optimistic about Christians than many of his followers. During the first four decades of the 7th century, Muslim armies came into contact with the defenses of the Christian Middle East, and they quickly discovered that even though they gave appropriate warnings, the Christians were not quickly converting for some reason. And therefore, animosity continued to grow as time went on between the Muslims and the Christians. The Muslim troops themselves threw themselves into this passionate vision of transforming the world by either sword or conversion, and this created a great deal of tension on the Christian side. Those who had seen what the Muslims had done in the lands that they conquered went back to the West with horror stories. They told of the slaughter of the Jews. They told of the desecration of the holy places of Christianity. They told of the destruction of monasteries and the slaughter of monks. And as a result, the West became very jittery whenever the topic of the scourge of the desert arose. Now, at that time, between the Western world as we think of it, Europe and the North, and the Middle East as we think of it, the lands of the Mediterranean Near East, between them lay the great lumbering civilization known as Byzantium. The far-flung Byzantine Empire was an aging but glorious monument to the beneficence of Christian culture. Throughout the Middle East, across North Africa, deep into the heart of Europe, imperial stability and steadfastness had spawned a remarkable flowering of culture. There's just about nothing in this world as transcendentally beautiful as Byzantine architecture. Whether it's the Byzantine architecture of the great palaces of the rulers and the emperors, or the Byzantine architecture of the wayside chapels, or the glorious cathedrals like the Hagia Sophia in the city of Constantinople, Byzantine architecture was magnificent. In addition, they had created the most efficient legal system in the world based upon biblical law. Government was limited and decentralized. Trade was free and prosperous. Families were stable and secure. Perversity and corruption were suppressed, while personal liberty and civil rights were enhanced. Advancement in the sciences was unprecedented. The engineering feats of the Byzantines alone should strike us with a sense of awe and wonder. The bridges they built, the harbors they forged, the feats of naval engineering they achieved, their vision for the transport of water and food, the building of highways. It was an incredible culture. One visitor to the capital from the West, Fulcher of Chartres, expressed his complete awe at the vast achievements of Byzantine culture. This Frankish lord wrote, "How splendid a civilization, how stately, how fair, how spiritually inclined, how many palaces raised by sheer labor in its highways and streets, how many works of art marvelous to behold. It would be wearisome to tell of the abundance of all good things, of gold and silver, of charity and grace, of garments of varied appearance, and of sacredness unimaginable." It was a city marked by beauty, this great city of Constantinople, but it was only one of many magnificent metropolises that spread all across the Byzantine world. The Byzantines transformed the city of Alexandria into a great seat of learning, the place where the repository of the ancient world's wisdom was held in one of the magnificent wonders of the world, a library the likes of which the world had never seen before and never will again. If you ever in London have the opportunity to visit the new British Library at St. Pancras, it's a sight to behold. But all indications are it pales in comparison to the great library at Alexandria, the gem, the jewel of Byzantine civilization. In addition, the cities of Antioch and Jerusalem had flourished under the Byzantines and had been transformed into icons of Christian civilization itself. This remarkable Byzantine civilization was described by another visitor in the 5th century, Medoc of Allier, marveled at the general happiness of Byzantine culture. The evident misery in so many other domains is seemingly altogether absent here in the East. The prosperity and liberty enjoyed by all has had a melodious effect upon them. industry and labor is undertaken with gladness of heart. Benediction is upon every tongue. Surely God's grace has rested upon them. Building on the legal code of Justinian, the Byzantines had created a kind of decentralized system of governance that drew from biblical law and made application to diverse peoples that brought about unprecedented freedoms. This great civilization that lay between the rising tide of the terror of the desert, Islam, and the Western world was considered by many in the West the linchpin and the great hope of the future of Christian civilization. Nobody in the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th centuries, 14th century, 15th century, could imagine what the world would be like if Constantinople ever fell to the barbarian hordes. In fact, when it finally did fall, 1,000 years after Byzantine civilization had been set into motion, the panic across the Western world was palpable. Christopher Columbus was 2 years old. He remembered to his dying day the sense of panic that ran through the streets of the city of Genoa on the day when ships came announcing that the unimaginable had occurred. Constantinople had fallen. He recalled in his journals how the bells of the city tolled with a funeral sadness. How grown men fell to their knees and grasped their breast and cried out for mercy, knowing that all was lost. The world was surely coming to an end because the heart, the soul, the gem, the center of Christendom was now in the hands of the barbarians. The Byzantine church at the time was quite robust as well, though racked by the heresies aforementioned, Monophysitism, Arianism, Nestorianism, and though rather moribund and growing more so with every day, it still boasted some of the most incredible preachers that the church has ever produced. You read today the sermons of people like John Chrysostom and John of Damascus, and it is striking how powerful, how affecting, how evangelical, how reformed they sound. This is long before the strictures of what today we know of as Eastern Orthodoxy had begun to suffocate the life out of the gospel. The evangelistic missionary endeavors of the Byzantine church had spread the gospel message from Scandinavia to China, from the depths of Africa to the steppes of Russia. Theological orthodoxy was ensured by regular creedal councils and canonical synods and conciliar presbyteries that decentralized authority and power among the several episcopacies and patriarchates. There is much, as a Presbyterian, that I see in the Byzantine church that I'd love to wave a magic wand over and change, and yet here was a repository of the ages of beauty, goodness, and truth that had withstood the assaults of every heresy, every difficulty, and now was the bulwark against this rising tide of Islam. Despite all of the apparent strengths, however, that existed in the Byzantine world, the fact is that there were a number of weaknesses as well. Most significantly, the long-lived stability of the imperial order had encouraged a lax estimation of the importance of military preparedness. Many eyewitness observers of the sack of Constantinople bore testimony to the fact that many in the imperial family stood by aghast as the city was ransacked by the barbarian hordes from the desert, saying things like, "But this can't be happening. We've been here for 1,000 years. This can't be so." It reminds me of the stories that I heard just a couple of years ago in Hollywood, of Hollywood starlets saying, "How can Bush have won? I don't know anyone who voted for him." You're living in a pretty narrow world now. One of the problems was is that for 1,000 years the Byzantines had constructed this glorious Christian order, and oftentimes their enemies, when they did have to go off to battle, were enemies who respected that order or were actually from within that order, and so they actually observed rules of civility in warfare. So when they faced the Muslims, they were surprised. They were surprised at the disregard of human life. In a number of the early battles against the Muslims would literally send up waves of human beings and deliberately send them to be piled up into huge human piles. The Byzantines used to some sort of order, even in warfare, were astonished. They were shocked. They were revulsed. Oftentimes, we're told that Byzantine armies would retreat merely at the smell of the rotting corpses on the battlefield, because the Muslims would send wave after wave after wave, totally disregarding human life. After all, awaiting those martyrs in paradise was some hubba hubba. 70 hubba hubbas. One imperial observer, Lenicus Chrysostein, stated at the time, "It's almost as if they are driven by the very demons of hell itself. They are in no wise tempted by comfort or safety. Instead, I dare say they relish the ardor of battle and welcome the horrors of death." They did not fight for themselves or their homelands or their ideology or their race. Their valor was unreserved. They fought for Allah and they died for paradise. The Caliph Umar, who led some of those early stinging campaigns along the southern frontier of Syria and ultimately into Egypt itself, was a stern giant of a man with a long dark beard and a full brooding countenance. He wore these nasty, coarse, frayed garments. Same garments for 18 years without a change. Carried a whip, and they once were white, and apparently by the time they rotted off of his flesh, they weren't white anymore. He carried a whip in his right fist in order to enforce righteous humility among his men. He had a little appreciation for the accomplishments of Byzantium and thought nothing of torching the great library at Alexandria, desecrating every church in his path. He took particular pleasure in raping nuns. He believed that it was healthy for him to wash his long, gnarled beard in the blood of young Christian virgins. Now this seemingly monstrous man was single-minded in his desire to bring the empire to its knees. According to the Shah Nima, contemporary chronicle of caliphs and kings, Umar despised the Christian infidels for what he called their half-faith and yearned to force confessions, creeds, and liturgies into extinction. The chronicler writes, "Umar, may he ever have peace, coveted nothing in the flesh save the undoing of Christian arrogance. For Jews are impotent and pagans are powerless, but in Christians he saw challenge. Therefore his meat was their humiliation, his drink was their shame, his humor was their downfall, his very breathing was their destruction. To see the whole earth bow in submission to Allah was his sure desire, but to see Christendom fall was his great delight." Clearly Umar pursued that delight with great vigor and proficiency. By 634, his armies had completed their conquest of Syria. By 635, he controlled much of Egypt. And by 636, he had defeated the Byzantines decisively in the great battle of Yarmouk, thus attaining unchallenged authority throughout the Fertile Crescent. But he wasn't done, and he wasn't satisfied. In February 638, he entered Jerusalem riding on a white camel. He was a Messiah figure. As always, he was dressed in his worn, filthy robes, and the army that followed him was rough and unkempt. But its discipline was perfect, and its victory complete. The cardinal city of Christendom, with all of its shrines and relics and monasteries and holy places. He went on to detail outrages of the jihad, the plunder of the churches, the rape of Christian women, the torture of the priests and the monks, the pilfering of villages and towns, the occupation of territories. He appealed to both their sense of Christian mercy and their sense of chivalric honor. "Recall the greatness of Charlemagne," he said. "O most valiant soldiers, descendants of invincible ancestors, be not degenerate. Let all hatred between you depart. All quarrels end. All wars cease. Start upon the road to the Holy Sepulchre. To tear that land from a wicked race and subject it to yourselves, thereby restoring its Christ, I call you to take the cross and redeem defiled Jerusalem." Immediately, a stirring chant arose from the crowd there at Clermont. "Deus vult! Deus vult! God wills it!" Immediately, gallant knights, inspired by pure religious zeal, left home and country to embark on a just and holy war against what they believed were crass infidel oppressors. Now, to be sure, the lure of booty, the mystery of the Orient, the promise of indulgences, the remission of penance, the aspiration to gain a feudal benefice, and a chaste sense of justice and chivalry were all a part of the motivations of those who first went on crusade. But it is so important that we put this all in its proper perspective. We think nothing of rushing across the globe these days on the flimsiest of pretexts to go and rescue one tin pan despot after another, while simultaneously, categorically denigrating the Crusades. It doesn't make a lot of sense. A case can be made for the First Crusade a whole lot easier from biblical grounds than the case can be made for a war in Afghanistan or for the liberation of Kuwait. And yet we're entirely incognizant of these things. We tend to apologize for the Crusades. Anytime there is a war, there will be atrocities. And unmonitored, unregulated warfare will always tend to get out of hand. But as Stephen Runciman has pointed out in his remarkable work, somewhere on the table here, if I'd been here earlier, I would have held up the one Steve Wilkins book that's on the table and really commended it to you and hauled out a whole slew of others to point out. I'll do that tomorrow. As Stephen Runciman points out in his book on the First Crusade, that there rarely has been a foreign war with as much warrant as this war. The Crusaders that went forth and they fought for the liberation of the peoples. And an army of about 50,000 Europeans, outfitted and supported by the Byzantines, drove southward and achieved remarkable success. Finally retaking Jerusalem in 1099. For the first time in their short history, the Muslim horde fled in retreat. The bludgeon of the jihad and the dhikma seem to have been broken, at least for a time. And then the Crusaders went to work. They planted their gardens, and they built their churches, and they constructed their roads, and they opened up the aqueducts and brought fresh water into the towns and restored the rule of law and began to apply principles of Christian chivalry to the once dominated land. And over the course of the next 100 years or so, created a civilization, oftentimes referred to as Outremer, across the sea, a civilization of remarkable beauty, free from many of the strictures of feudal Europe. They were actually able to create an idealized vision of Christian culture. To be sure, there were tyrants. To be sure, there were entrepreneurs of greed and vice among them. And yet, we have here a snapshot of what can be done when Christians attempt in the midst of this poor fallen world to create a culture that truly reflects Christian values and Christian principles. It was a place where art and music and literature once again thrived. That's the great legacy of the Crusades. In 1144, the Saracens, as they then were called, the Muslims, reorganized their armies and began to chip away at the borders of Outremer. The city of Edessa fell. A renewed crusade led by the kings of France and Germany failed to recover it. All of Europe was stunned, and yet the worst was yet to come. In 1150, one of the greatest warriors Islam ever produced, a great knight of Islamic zeal and passion named Salah ad-Din, united the Islamic world under his leadership and began to chip away at the remaining Christian holdings. In 1187, he defeated the Crusaders at the decisive Battle of Hattin on July the 4th. He then captured Jerusalem and overran virtually all the Latin territories except the great harbor city of Acre. Another series of crusades were launched by such notables as King Richard I of England, Emperor Frederick II of Germany, King Louis of France, later to be known as St. Louis. Under their leadership, Western armies valiantly won back a few swatches of most of the lands between Joppa and Acre, but their flagging campaigns were generally ineffectual, and Jerusalem was again lost in 1244, and Acre fell in 1291. But that wasn't the end of crusading. Additional crusades or attempts at crusades or fantasies about crusades continued to be a theme that would run all throughout Christian literature. You can't really understand the literature of the West until you come to terms with the pervasiveness of the need to somehow rid the world of that aching vice known as Islam. It's the overriding theme of Don Quixote. It's one of the overriding concerns of Shakespeare's tragedies. It's at the heart of much of the great poetry that was produced all the way up through to the Reformation. If you look at the period of the Reformation, you begin to realize that people like Calvin and Luther were just as concerned about the Saracen threat then camped within 50 miles of Vienna as they were about the threats of the Habsburg Emperor Charles V. And so it was that men like Christopher Columbus were inspired to sail across the ocean in order to rear flank the Muslim horde and ultimately to build a cathedral on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. That's why he went on to discover America. He didn't want to discover America. He wanted to rear flank the Muslims. He wanted to form a grand alliance with the great Khan of China and march against the Muslim horde. You can't understand the writings of people like Cotton Mather in early America unless you understand how pervasive that this understanding was that the greatest threat to the spread of Christian civilization to the uttermost parts of the earth was the roadblock placed in the way of missionaries by Islam. all the way through to World War I and the time of Lawrence of Arabia and John Buchan and all of the great writers of the Christian tradition from Great Britain, like Rudyard Kipling, all were reflecting on this. How is it that we've forgotten? How is it that somehow we were lulled to sleep in the last 50 years to begin to think that defining feature of Christian civilization for the last 1,000 years has somehow lost its relevance? And then we're surprised by Osama? We're surprised by Yasser? We're surprised by Ayatollahs? What have we been thinking about? How could we have forgotten so quickly? This is one of the great central themes. Read the story of William Carey as he goes to India. And what's one of the things that he's thinking about? I must go to India because if we can somehow create a wedge between Christian Europe and the Islamic Middle East, perhaps the task of the Great Commission may be accomplished. Read the story of Hudson Taylor, and you'll find long passages in his diaries detailing his concerns to bring the gospel to China so that the opportunity to lock off Islam was brought to the Christian world. Recently, I had a radio interview with a national conservative radio show, and the interview was with me and one of a primary Middle Eastern experts in the Bush administration. Go figure. How I got him. Anyway. So it's Doofus George and this Middle Eastern expert. It was very interesting to me that as the questions came, the Middle Eastern expert kept giving the same basic answer to every question. I don't know. And during one of the commercial breaks, I said, why is it that you don't know so much? He said, you have to understand that for the last 50 years, no one has been seriously studying the Islamic world from an ideological, philosophical, or spiritual perspective. We know all about their strategic oil reserves. We know nothing about what they're thinking. One of the great tasks that Christ has given us is the task to go forth into the midst of this poor, fallen world and bring the hope and the life of the gospel. But in order to do that, we have to know where the obstacles are. We have to understand what stands in the way of the accomplishment of that great ideal. Guys like William Carey and J. Hudson Taylor and Thomas Chalmers and John Buchan, they all understood very clearly what was at stake and what was required. Well, we've hardly got a clue. It's hard for us to even imagine why anybody would ever set out on crusade. But I dare say that the knights of Christendom in the 11th and 12th centuries would look at us askance and say, wake up! What are you thinking about? Stir yourselves to action! Go to work! You're losing the world by sheer ignorance. And you don't even know it. Your biggest complaint is the shakedown that you get when you go and check in at Delta. Jesus gives us this glorious call. It is a glorious call to go forth and to proclaim the gospel to every nation, in every tongue, to every tribe across the globe. The recent state of terrorism, hijackings, the bombings, the kidnappings, the attacks, even the direct military confrontations that have been inflicted upon the West is clear testimony to the fact that Islam's jihad is anything but a forgotten relic of the past. The Taliban and the Al-Qaeda are the natural results of a consistent Islamic worldview. But we're still thinking like moderns, like revolutionaries. We're still applying a Marxist model to the world. We're still attempting to play Freud to a world on the couch. The only hope for us is to resort to a distinctive biblical worldview where we can look at the worldview of Islam through the lens of the Scriptures and understand its essence and undermine its weaknesses with all of the power that the gospel affords us. And that is our only substantive hope. During the days of the mobilization for World War I, when it looked for a time that the American troops would be deployed in the Middle East against the fierce Ottomans, a young Presbyterian pastor from Birmingham, Alabama, James Alexander Bryan, later known as the patron saint of the city of Birmingham, the only pastor that I know of who has a statue portraying him in the posture of prayer in a central urban city park. This remarkable man eloquently expressed the key message of the ages as we confront the dilemma of Islam. Let all be done in bathed prayer. Our working and our playing, our eating and our sleeping, our dreaming and our doing, let all be done in bathed prayer. But most particularly, when we know that our boys, our sons, and our brothers, our husbands, must face those denizens of terror from the desert realms of the Levant, should we bathe our very inner being, our breathing, and our thinking in prayer? Dost thou not know that the hosts of Cain and the minions of Babel, the legions of the Saracen and the hordes of Arabia are set from eternity against the covenant people? Pray therefore, night and day, pray, moment by moment, pray, pray for mercy. Oh, dear souls, pray. Pray because the passion for jihad will not go away simply because we deploy troops in impressive and deadly array. Pray because the desire for Dehima will continually divide East and West. Pray because despite our carefully constructed international coalitions and strategic alliances, we face a deadly foe. Pray because it's never over till it's over. Oh God, equip and enable us to take this seriously, to act seriously, to pray seriously, to mobilize seriously, to train seriously, to equip seriously, and to go forth seriously. The fate of millions, billions hangs in the balance, and we know that only too well. In these days of disarray and uncertainty and upheaval, we do understand that the fields are white unto harvest. The opportunity is great. Send us, Lord, send us. Give us a passion for the world. Send us. We pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.